Welcome to Ballistic Radio. Join us as we discuss hard-won self-defense lessons, as well as the information you need to survive a violent encounter. Listen as armed professionals, industry experts, national champions, and gunfight survivors help answer all your firearms and self-defense questions while exploring your rights and responsibilities as an armed citizen. Ballistic Radio, brought to you by Daniel Defense, the country's leading manufacturer of AR rifles and accessories. Daniel Defense, lighter, stronger, better. And now, here is your host, John Johnston.
Welcome to Ballistic Radio, brought to you by Daniel Defense, the country's leading manufacturer of AR rifles and accessories. Daniel Defense, lighter, stronger, better. I'm your host, John Johnston. Remember, you can always listen to past shows at ballisticradio.com. Get the latest behind-the-scenes info, arguments, photos, videos, other stuff at facebook.com/ballisticradio. Co-hosting with me, Melody Lauer.
Hello!
I like that. It's kind of like, it's reminiscent of Jack's We, but you've put your own spin on it.
Oh. So. I've just been like, hi!
I mean, that could work too.
People who know me know me.
That's really profound. Yes, people that know you do know you.
You know exactly what I mean.
And people that don't know you don't know you.
People who don't know me are like, this woman's crazy.
My mama says not to talk to strangers.
No, that's not how it is.
Anyway. Hey, guess what?
What's that?
This segment brought to you by Lucky Gunner and Federal Premium Ammunition. Whether there was a firefight or you do, in fact, want to worry about that little guy, you need more ammo. And when it's time to restock, you can't beat Federal Premium Ammunition at LuckyGunner.com. With a shipping department that's always moving at 88 miles per hour, if I order a case of American Eagle from Lucky Gunner on a Thursday, it's at my doorstep, ready to shoot before the weekend starts. Head to LuckyGunner.com today to check out their in-stock lineup of Federal Premium Ammunition. And remember, unless you're on fire or drowning, you can never really have too much ammo. So, for those that listened to last week's episode, you'll kind of notice a trend. We're talking about red dots for the next little bit. And joining us, his first appearance on the show, Aaron Cowan. Aaron, how's it going, man?
Pretty good, how about yourself?
Oh, I can't complain, dude. Thanks for taking time out of your day to come record this episode with us. I really appreciate
it.
For those that don't know, who are you? What do you do? What's your company? And we'll just go from there.
Aaron Cowan with Sage Dynamics. Provide mostly self-defense focused training within my lane. Handgun, carbine, rifle. I do a lot of force on force. I'm a pretty, I guess, psychophysiological focused instructor. So I like to get people as mentally and physically prepared for self-defense as possible, looking at the way the human body behaves and how we can best maximize the equipment that we use to defend ourselves in relation to that.
Nice. So I guess my first question is, you know, the last 10 years or so, red dots have become much more prevalent on handguns, specifically slide-mounted red dots, stuff like that. Can you walk me through your thought arc, I guess, on when these first started coming around, what you thought about them versus where you're at now?
Yeah, so first slide-mounted red dot I had was probably about, I'd say, almost 6 years ago now. And I had shot them before, but the very first one I owned put some time in with. And I encountered the same problem that most shooters do initially, in the fact that I wasn't as fast, I wasn't as consistent. Even though from an understanding of red dot optics, I could see how if I could get it to work, it was going to be more efficient because your eye requires less reaccommodation when using a red dot optic than it does use an iron sight.
Right.
Once I finally just kind of made the connection in my head of, okay, I need to really harness just that natural eye-hand coordination to really make this optic work correctly for that initial alignment from the draw or from the holster or what have you. And that's when it really clicked, and that's when I started seeing consistent, repeatable performance above iron sights with the red dot. Right. Go ahead.
No, I'm sorry for interrupting. Please finish your thought.
And that was right about the time, and I was like, okay, well, this is working great on paper, so let me go ahead and put one on a force-on-force gun. So I had one of my Simunitions FX slides milled through a red dot on that, and I've been collecting data for almost 5 years now, my own personal evolution scenarios, and then allowing students to use it in classes, and then there was a specific study I did with the dot for the white paper that I published.
Right.
And that's when I was pretty much pushed well over the ledge on, okay, this is despite some of the drawbacks that exist with the system, this is the way we need to be headed.
Well, so let me ask you this, and I just had Scott Jutlinski on to talk about some stuff from his perspective, and I wanted to get your take on it too, but it seems to me that it requires quite a bit of emotional control for people to, especially when they're for the first time ever confronted with someone that they need to shoot, whether it's real life or, in force on force with some munitions, to make themselves look at the bumpy things on top of the gun.
Absolutely.
And they don't always do that. Do you think that's where the red dot kind of has an advantage, or do you want to talk about that some?
I mean, if you look at it from a physiological standpoint, and this is a little bit philosophical, but there's definitely some credence to it. I mean, we've been fighting with weapons for 400,000 years, whereas firearms have been on the scene for right around 500 and change. And of course, those are gross numbers. You can get specifically into the numbers if you want to.
Right.
And the iron sighted weapon, be it rifle or handgun or what have you, is the only weapon system we've ever really created that required us to stare at the weapon itself to get our desired point of aim to impact where we wanted to impact on threat. Every other weapon we've ever used in combat, be it self-defense or, you know, on a grand scale, we've looked at the threat. And the human, especially the reptilian brain, seems to be very hard focused on, when your sympathetic nervous system activates, to just focusing on the threat itself. And the red dot obviously lends itself very well to shooting that way.
Right.
So I think just as if you want to use the word natural, I'd use the word natural. From a natural advantage, that's where it really shines.
Mm-hmm. It seems it's kind of one of those things where, so we've got like a lot of anecdotal evidence of people not doing well when they threat focus with irons and have not highly trained. I mean, that's essentially what happens anytime you see a police shooting where a ton of rounds gets fired and there's only periphery hits or no hits at all. I mean, any shooting instructor can tell you what's happening, right?
Mm-hmm.
So do you think untrained people will do better with a red dot as far as if they have a little bit of fundamentals, or is that one of those things where, you know, no matter what sighting system you're utilizing, you still need to put the work in?
That's been my experience to a certain degree. I've had students come to classes with different experience backgrounds. And again, experience is one of those words that it doesn't necessarily mean good experience. It just means this is how long they've been shooting. Now, they could have been shooting incorrectly the entire time or inefficiently the entire time.
Right.
But I've had students, literally the first time they'd seriously used a red dot was like, hey, I want to try the red dot gun for my scenario to see how it goes.
Yeah,
and their performance was pretty impressive compared to the scenarios they'd run with iron sights. Sometimes remarkably so. And across the board, I'm seeing better critical hits. Now, force on force isn't real life. It's as close as we can get if properly conducted. But I think there's a lot of credence and evidence saying that the red dot is allowing people to get more knowledgeable hits and put the rounds roughly where they want them to go if the bad guy participates on his end, because I mean he gets a say in the final sight picture,
right?
And I think there's definitely something there to be said for the learning curve. I would consider it to be shorter. I think people still need to be proficient on the iron sights, but from a self defense perspective, I think that the dot is going to lend itself much better to the way we naturally want to do things, and I think that's where shooters pick it up quicker.
So why do you think people still need to be good with the irons? So let's say we were taking a new shooter and we were just going to give them a dot gun. Would you start them out on irons first anyway, or would it depend?
I think I would have to take it at an individual level, but if I could make the decision from shooter to shooter, I would probably start them out on the dot first and then transition them to iron sights. I think it's important to maintain proficiency, at least of course, proficiency is one of those nebulous topics with what is proficient. We usually come up with some kind of itemized test to prove someone's proficiency, but I would say that the iron sights is important because the technology, while it's certainly improved in the past 10 years, I mean, even in the past 5 years, there's still a chance that the optic can go down, worst case scenario.
Right.
So some degree of proficiency with the iron sights, if you need to transition to them, is prudent. I mean, you look at rifles, you know, red dot technology is really, really good on rifles, and people still have backup sights just in case.
Right. Well, and I mean, there's some guys that are starting to not run backups anymore, though.
Oh, absolutely.
And not like guys that, oh, yeah, I hang out in forums a lot or whatever. These are guys that have spent a lot of time doing good things to bad people and are like, you know what? This is more weight that I don't want to carry around. So, mm-hmm. You know, is the stuff we're putting on pistols to the point where the stuff we're putting on rifles is or not yet? As far as reliability goes. Let me do this. I'm sorry, dude. We got to go to break real quick. Talking with Aaron Cowan from Sage Dynamics. You're listening to Ballistic Radio. To Ballistic Radio, brought to you by Daniel Defense, the country's leading manufacturer of AR rifles and accessories. Daniel Defense, lighter, stronger, better. This segment brought to you by Wilson Combat. Wilson Combat, makers of the finest custom 1911s and scatterguns since 1977. Legacy of quality, innovation, and service. Learn more about their firearms and accessories, as well as the new EDC X9, which offers discriminating shooters 1911 match-grade accuracy, superior ergonomics and concealability, with modern service pistol capacity and reliability at www.wilsoncombat.com. So we're talking with Aaron Cowan from Sage Dynamics. Sorry I had to interrupt you for the break, but I was asking before we left, is the technology that we're putting on the pistols as durable or robust as the ones that we're putting on the rifles or not yet?
I would say it depends on the brand. I'm pretty Triggercon loophole centric when it comes to MRDS for handguns.
Yeah.
My experience with the Triggercon RMR, even with the Type 1, has been very good. I've got one of my original Type 1 RMRs that's getting ready to break 14,500 rounds.
Yeah.
That'll probably happen sometime tomorrow or the next day. So we look at, you know, how many rounds do you expect to fire? What kind of ammunition you shoot? How do you train? How do you practice? What environment do you work in? I would be perfectly comfortable, just based on my experience with all these different optics and just the time that I have on them, taking a good quality service pistol, throwing an RMR on it, and not really worrying about the iron sights. I don't think as a shooting community, most people are going to be ready to make that commitment.
Yeah.
I know there's a few guys out there that already have been like, okay, well, I don't really even worry about the sights. Like, they'll throw an RMR on a milled gun and they won't even change out the stock sights because they're like, well, I'm not going to use them anyway.
So
I think that's a growing minority of shooters where we're like, okay, the technology with certain brands is where it needs to be, so I'm comfortable with it.
Right.
And then it comes down to, you know, individual user. If you're going to buy a Vortex or a J-Point or a Shield, probably not. Just because in my experience, the durability of those optics just isn't really there for concealed carry or for duty use.
Well, it's funny, too, like how disparate people's experiences can be because, you know, I have not played with dots nearly as much as you have or someone like Jedi has, but I have played with them more than most people. I have broken like three or four of the first gen RMRs. I've got one of the Type 2s now, and that's held up pretty well. I've actually got two of the Type 2s right now. Just remembered, but it's funny like how much it's improved. Like the original loopholes, those broke if you looked at them funny, at least in my experience. You know what I mean? So
no, absolutely, that's funny. I have a Unicorn original Delta Point that it has. I'd have to look at my book to see what the exact round count is, but it's over 10,000 rounds on it, and it's still putting along. I don't use it much anymore just because I don't like the reticle compared to what's available now.
Yeah,
I just got my first Delta Point Pro, and I'm going to start putting rounds on that. But, yeah, I mean, I've known people who bought a brand-new Type 1, threw it in the gun, and within 75 rounds, it had gone down for whatever reason, and they had to send it in.
Yeah.
And that's why I try to, you know, I try to have the largest sample size I can. Right now, I'm running five different guns with both Type 1 and Type 2 RMRs, and, they get used pretty frequently for my own personal practice and for teaching, so I'm able to get round counts on them probably at a more accelerated rate than some shooters would be able to.
Right.
As far as other brand optics go, I usually give them, you know, I'll buy the optic, I'll try it out. If it breaks, I'll buy another one. If that one breaks, I'm kind of done with it until the next generation comes out.
Nice. And well, it's funny too, though, like, because there's a couple guys that, whether it's Red Dots or like certain brands, stuff doesn't work for everyone else, but for whatever reason, they're like, it's always been fine for me. It's like Claude Werner and crappy guns. Claude Werner is the crappy gun whisperer because he'll get stuff that I can't make run to save my life. And it's like, yeah, it runs fine. So it's almost like there's this aura of, it's like, okay, I'll work for you. Which is, when you say you've got an original loophole that's still good, and I'm like, okay, cool. You know? And I think people, there's no accounting for luck sometimes, you know?
Yeah.
Or whatever, like that field of anti-entropy is. As far as for, if people are going to think about using Red Dots or, you know, are going to think about incorporating them into their lives, what are some of the things that they need to think about if they're going to do that?
Well, the first thing is probably going to be as soon as you get it mounted on your gun, whatever you're chosen, if you're going to have it milled, if you're going to get a West or one of the other factory-ready optics-capable handguns, or you're going to use something like a Baylor or something like that, once you get kind of comfortable with it, you need to get into a class that's focused on building the skill set to use the optic. And some people don't like to hear that. They like to know that they can do it on their own just because, well, it's what's the difference from iron sights to a red dot. And there is a significant difference. And sometimes it's going to be, you're going to spend less money having someone walk you through it than you would spending that same amount of money on ammunition trying to figure it out on your own. So there's definitely a value added there. Once it clicked with me, I probably had, I'd say maybe 3,000-4,000 rounds. So if I equate that to that money spent on a class, I could have got to the same point faster and then used that money for ammunition to train myself to a higher level of efficiency. So I could have put the cart in front of the horse, so to speak, and made them both run.
Yeah.
And that's not what I did, because at the time there weren't a lot of people out there teaching red dot centric handgun courses. Some people think it's going to be just the same as the rifle, whereas, you know, in the rifle, we generally have 4 points of contact, whereas the handgun, we only have two, and it's kind of floating in front of our face. And the problem that I see consistently is a really, really small one. It's an eye-to-optic alignment issue versus an optic-to-target issue. But overcoming that sometimes requires someone to walk you through the steps so you understand the process, so you can kind of build it into your inherent skill set. You know, build those neural pathways, if you will, get the Ingrams and the Hebbian plasticity working for you with your proprioception, your hand-eye coordination, and all that.
Right.
And it'll click.
When you say that, go into depth as far as what you mean as far as eye alignment versus target alignment.
Well, and then this is a consistent problem I see with shooters, is the rifle kind of helps us in a way that we have a cheek weld or something close to a cheek weld. So the red dot is more or less put in the envelope that it needs to be in order for eye alignment to take place to align that to the target. With the handgun, people generally draw and present the firearm in a way that they don't see the dot, and that's the biggest problem. That's where most people feel like it's slower, because they're presenting and they're having to then fish for the dot inside the optic window. Yeah. What I have students do, one of the first things I'll have them do is I'll have them draw out, point at a target, and ask them, do you see the dot? And if the answer is no, I tell them not to move anything. Leave their grip, their point, everything the same. Now move your head around a little bit. And what most of them, almost all of them, will find consistently is the dot is roughly where they wanted it to be, but it wasn't, the optic body itself wasn't aligned to their eye for them to be able to see that. So their eye-hand coordination put the gun roughly where it needed to be, but they weren't able to see that to make those final fine corrections we generally make on iron sights. So they have to kind of have a re-understanding of how to fine-tune their eye-hand coordination to align their eye to their hands to where the dot's going to be.
Well, and it seems like, too, that I run into a lot of shooters, especially in the classes that we teach, where people have no understanding of just where their head's going to be or getting it in the same spot each time or just all sorts of, like, there's no repeatability anyway. You know,
yeah.
And adding a dot to that situation doesn't really make it much better, you know? So,
yeah, I can definitely see that.
But, and that's more of a training issue though, where people start blaming the dot for things that are not necessarily the dot's fault. Do you think that happens a lot?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
And, anything in particular that jumps out at you other than that?
Well, I think it's the same problem that we have across the board with some students or some mentalities about training versus practice. You'll have someone come to a class and they're still struggling with some pretty simplistic things. And it's not against them. It's just maybe it didn't really occur to them. But if I have a student come to a class and he's having problems with reloads or hitting the slide release or something like that, I have to ask him, like, how long have you owned this gun? How long have you been shooting? You know, and the answer is usually, you know, a year, 2 years, 3 years, 4 years. Very rarely is the answer like 10 minutes. And I have to ask them, like, okay, well, why weren't you practicing this on your own?
Yeah.
Why did you come to a client? Like, granted, if you have an inefficiency, I'm going to help you fix it. I'm going to do the best that I can to help you identify your inefficiencies and your reload, your draw stroke, what have you. But you could have built a core competency in this skill set before you even came to this class. And usually people like, you know, I never thought about it like that. Dry fire is one of those things that some people think dry fire is literally just getting in trigger reps.
Well, hold that thought because we got to go to break. So right now we're talking with Aaron Cowan from Sage Dynamics. You're listening to Ballistic Radio. Welcome back to Ballistic Radio, brought to you by Daniel Defense, the country's leading manufacturer of AR rifles and accessories. Daniel Defense, lighter, stronger, better. This segment brought to you by Surefire. Know your target and what is beyond it. But how can you really know your target? By shining a really bright light at it, and that's where Surefire comes in. From the new 1200 lumen EDCL 2T handheld, or 500 lumen EDCL 1T handheld, to the 1000 lumen XH35 or 300 lumen XC1B, Surefire can make sure you never have to yell "Aziz light" ever again. Now, with more lumens and improved switching, the best just got brighter. Surefire. And as a special offer to Ballistic Radio listeners, you can get 30% off everything at the Surefire.com web store except batteries and suppressors by entering the discount code ALLTHELUMENS, that is ALLTHELUMENS, at Surefire.com. So we're talking with Aaron Cowan from Sage Dynamics. And before the break, I interrupted you, and I'd like for you to continue, please, sir.
Where did I leave off? So we're talking about building that base level core competency.
Yes.
And how that can go a long way towards helping a student when they take their first class. Because we go to train to learn what we don't know, or to have an objective party identify our inefficiencies.
Right.
I know early on in my experience shooting that I tended to practice things that I was already good at.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really hard to excel or build your skill level beyond what you're comfortable with if you don't ever work on it. And that seems like common sense. But I think any shooter, I wouldn't say any, I think a lot of shooters could sit and think to themselves, like, well, you know, last time I went to the range, I really only worked on stuff I was already good at. I think if you allow someone else to set your performance wall for you, if they're doing it, you know, with an eye towards where your skill level's at, you know, obviously you don't want to try to get them 12 steps ahead from day one. That's going to help build, or I should say solidify the foundation of your basic understanding of the fundamentals and how efficient you are in employing them. And then when you try to transition from iron sights, say, to a red dot handgun, you're going to be much better served in that way. And of course you can do it the reverse as well. If you're new to shooting, starting out on the dot, if there's someone helping you along your path, it's obviously going to be better. But there's just so many things that we could do ourselves before we even take that class to make it easier for us to learn. Because if you're not very good at the basic fundamentals, then it's going to be harder for you to learn, I'm not going to say advanced skills, but it's going to be harder for you to learn how to solve certain problems using that skill set. If the skill set's already strong, then it makes problem solving easier.
Well, and So, I mean, that kind of becomes an interesting question, though. So, like, Melody and I had a student show up at a class we taught down at Oconee County Sheriff's Office that had literally bought the gun. Melody, when was that? Like, the week before? Or
yeah, he had never fired rounds through it. It had been just that week. And, yeah. Yeah, brand new gun.
Yeah, came out to our class. And, I mean, he, to his credit, he hung with it, and he ended up passing the quals that we run in our classes just because we like having a federal standard that we hold people to. But I mean, him practicing things on his own before class would have been not really possible, almost, just because he didn't even know where to start. So where's that line, I guess, between, okay, you want to practice before class, but you don't want to be practicing the wrong things. I mean, what would your advice be for people that are worried about that?
That's actually a pretty, I guess, difficult question, because you know how if someone has a bad technique, it's going to take them twice as long, at least current popular research on motor skills, it's going to take them twice as long to fix it than it did for them to learn it.
Yeah.
So not necessarily inefficient, but let's just say somebody's just doing something wrong. Like there's just no way that's even an inefficiency issue. Now they have twice the work set ahead of them to fix that inefficiency. There's a lot of good practice supplements out there. Obviously, you know, YouTube from myself and a bunch of my peers put out videos on techniques and things like that, and getting with shooters who already know things. I think everybody probably has a friend, I would hope, that has been shooting longer than them and can kind of help them along the way.
Yeah.
Of course, the dark side of that is there's a lot of shooters out there that believe themselves far more proficient than they actually are. So you have to hope that the person's getting help from the right person.
I've been shooting for years.
Exactly. I've got thousands of rounds through my gun in the past 10 years, and I know exactly what I'm doing.
Right. Right.
And some of those people really do. Like, some of them don't.
Yeah.
And I think that, like, I hate the cliche case by case basis statement, but it really is that to a certain degree, because most things in shooting are very anecdotal in nature, depending on what we're talking about. Like, if we have a bright line standard, if we're talking about, you know, the three favorite things we love to talk about in firearms, distance, accuracy, and speed, then you can create a metric with which to gauge someone's skill. But outside of that, what do we really have?
Right.
Especially when we start talking about self-defense-focused shooting, it makes it a little bit more difficult. And there's obviously way more artificialities built into training for self-defense than there is for training for competition.
And that becomes the other thing, too, that I don't think a lot of people like to talk about, and certainly in our community we don't like to talk about, is that there are multiple ways to accomplish the same goal, even though many of us will pick a specific hill and die on it repeatedly. And that is confusing to people that don't, you know, have no baseline to start from.
No, absolutely. And I've had people make the argument to me, like, well, you know, iron sights have been working on handguns, you know, for, you know, over a century or however long you want to go back. So why would I need to adopt a red dot? And my answer to that is usually like, well, no, they haven't been working. They've been allowing certain people to be successful despite the inefficiencies in the technology that existed. I mean, if you look at the evolution of iron sights on handguns, the last big advancement in technology was night sights, and they didn't even move the needle on accuracy in law enforcement and low light shootings.
Yeah.
So you have to be like, okay, well, we've been using this because it's all we had, but it wasn't the best way to do things. And if you look at how rifles have gone, it only makes sense that handguns are going to go the same way. But someone has to be honest with themselves to a certain degree in that conversation. And do I need this? And if I do need it, how much time and effort am I willing to get proficient at it? And then it goes back to, you know, what you said. Some people are going to stay on top of that iron sight hill to the end of time. Some
right.
people might come down and go over to the neighbors and see how the red dot thing's going. But yeah, you're absolutely right. There's a, you know, you can continue to carry an iron sighted gun for the rest of your life, and then the unlikely event that you actually, you know, need it for a self defense shooting, if you put the time in to stay proficient, you're probably going to be successful.
Yeah.
But I'm all about stacking the deck. And if someone wants to use a sighting system that's going to allow them to be more proficient if they put the same amount of time in and remove some of those negative aspects of iron sights that we have based on environment, and then improve their ability to positively identify their threat because they're going to be threat focused, which is more natural.
Yeah.
And that's kind of the way that I want to go with it.
Well, and so threat-focused shooting, if people don't know, and I think this is a big confusion that a lot of people that shoot irons have, mm-hmm. Threat-focused shooting is essentially you're focusing your vision on the threat. A lot of iron-sighted shooters will say things like, well, but then I can't see my irons, and it doesn't really work that way. And we've got guys, you know, like Ben Steger talks about it. I'm a, for the most part, target focus shooter, even with irons. So it can be done. You just need to know what you're doing and be good at it. And I want to get your response to that, but we have to go to break. So we're talking with Aaron Cowan from Sage Dynamics. You're listening to Ballistic Radio. Welcome back to Ballistic Radio, brought to you by Daniel Defense, the country's leading manufacturer of AR rifles and accessories. Daniel Defense, lighter, stronger, better. So before the break, we were talking about threat-focused shooting and whether you can do that with irons or not, and blah, blah, blah. And the issue becomes that, and I don't know that I agree or not, but a lot of people will say things like, you're going to be threat-focused. Now, I think that you are likely to be threat-focused, especially if you have not trained yourself not to be. And I would certainly agree that it's better to be threat-focused if you can still get your hits. But if you've not practiced shooting that way, is that where people start getting in the issues, or what are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think, and again, I'm going to talk from just my experience. I've trained under a lot of different instructors in my career, both in the Army and then classes I sat on my own, and then in law enforcement. And there's a generation of shooters that was so hard focused on everything iron sights that they kind of forget that there's a lot of evidence out there to the contrary. So for threat focused shooting, we factor in human physiology. We have this natural desire to focus on what's threatening us. So that kind of eliminates, at least momentarily to a certain degree, our ability to near focus on our threat or our sights. And then you got to look at what's the situation. Are we talking about a spontaneous shooting? Or are we talking about a judgment shooting? I know from my personal experience, spontaneous shooting, no sights. Judgment shooting, if I'm giving verbal commands, drop the knife, you know, step away from the door, whatever the situation was, if I didn't get my sights immediately, I would get them within the first, you know, second, 2 seconds, 3 seconds, however long. And again, depended on how much prior contact I had with the individual. And force on force, I see, you know, I always ask students, did you see your sights? Did you not see your sights? And generally the spontaneous scenarios where they have very little data, it's a late ID on a threat. Maybe it's literally a draw after a startle. They generally don't have them. The shootings that kind of develop based on a conversation or some kind of interaction, they generally do get their sights in those situations. But, and I use the word generally, you know, specifically to say that it's not always the case either way. I've got some shooters that I've had, you know, some of my alumni have been through, you know, 10 force on force classes with me, and they're getting their sights in every single scenario, regardless of how the situation develops.
Well, let me
ask, stress inoculation has a large part to do with it.
Yeah, exactly. But let me ask you this, and this is a sort of tangential conversation, and I don't know that we'll have enough time to get into it or not, but just even on certain shooting standards that I am able to do in a time frame that is very quick, but it's a tight enough target that it's not something that can be shot without using sights. At least in some level or another. But if you ask me, like, hey, did you see your sights? Like, well, yeah, they were there, I guess. I don't know. It's not really what I was thinking about. So how often do you think it is that people say stuff like, well, I didn't see my sights, when maybe they were unconsciously competent enough that that was all happening below, you know, the whatever it was that they were focused on? Do you know what I mean? That was a clumsy way to ask the question, but...
I definitely get what you're saying. I think you would have to take all the elements of the situation into account with a question like that, because was there actually good or not?
Yeah.
I think that's a huge factor. One of the demonstrations I do in my defensive handgun classes is I have a Glock 17 slide that has no sights on it whatsoever.
Right.
And I use that to demonstrate how efficient you can be with just eye-hand coordination if you put in the time to develop the skill set.
Sure.
I mean, it's kind of like stepping on a pitching mound for the first time. You're probably not going to get it in the strike zone.
Right.
You can develop the skill set. And I've actually been able to shoot and qualify on most of the qualifications I found with that slide.
Yeah.
Now, I'm not a scoring expert, but I'm able to consistently get hits in what's standardly considered an A zone back to 15 meters at rapid fire from the holster with no sights. And the cool thing about shooting with no sights is you don't really have to wait for your sights to settle and reset. You just keep pulling the trigger. And of course, I'm not advocating anyone go out and take the sights off their gun, but it serves as a good demonstration for students that the skill set is there. You just didn't know it, or maybe you haven't really explored it, because all the old breed instructors I ever trained under, that would have been like some kind of sacrilegious crime to even consider discussing that, because it's iron sights, front sight focus, front sight focus, front sight focus. The tool set is there. It's our natural eye-hand coordination. So I think we should help shooters as best as possible really explore that aspect, because I think it'll make you a more well-rounded shooter if you know I can still accomplish the same mission if I treat my iron sights like I do the sun. I don't stare right at it. I get a general sense of it, and I move on. If the situation requires that, then I know I can get hits.
Well, and that's – I think a lot of people sort of lose sight of the really what training and practice and all that does for you is just show you where you're at, so that when you find yourself in a particular whatever it is, you just kind of do what you already know you can do versus just trying to make stuff up on the spot. As far as the dots go, man, we got 5 or 6 minutes left. What would you tell people if they're considering doing this, not considering doing this? What would you leave them with?
Probably the best thing they could do, depending on budget. If you have the budget, get a milled slide, throw an RMR on it. And if you find that within, you know, and be honest with yourself, give it 2,000 or 3,000 rounds. And if you find like you can't really get into it on your own, then you, those things retain their value very well. So you can go ahead and sell it and recoup most of your investment. And then you can knowledgeably say, dots aren't for me. I think if people put in the time and they listen to the good advice that's already out there on how to develop the skill set with the red dot, there's no reason why, short of, say, an extreme astigmatism or something like that, why they won't be like, okay, this is way, way more proficient than iron sights. Maybe I'm shooting to the same degree or the same consistent accuracy and maybe even the same speed, but now I'm able to stay threat focused. And when I take this type of practice and I move it through different environments, say, you know, mesopic, indoor twilight, or out in, you know, low light situations, the best night sights you can have is a red dot. So as an overall package, they may find that, okay, for self-defense purposes, this is going to be great, but you got to put in the time. Like my classes, you know, I bring, you know, 3 or 4 dot guns with me.
Yeah.
So if somebody's dot curious, they can go ahead and run one.
You need to make a dot curious t-shirt if you haven't already, by the way. I mean, just do it now. You can have that one, dude. I'm not going to – this isn't going to air for 2 weeks. Just get it done, you know. I will say this, and this will be a nice, like, maybe point of contention that we can discuss next time you're on. Okay. I think red dots are great at night. I would actually argue a green laser is better, but that's – then you get into, like – problems with how are they mounted and switching and activation and stuff like that, but small disagreement, but that'd be a fun conversation.
Yeah.
So if people want to take a class with you or, you know, stuff like that, where can they get that info, and where are you teaching at mostly, or are you traveling around?
The calendar is on sagedynamics.org. You can also follow me on Instagram at sagedynamics or Twitter at sagedynamics. And you can get periodic updates to classes and if things have filled up or if there's a waiting list. But I still teach nationwide. I'm based out of Atlanta, so I do teach here, but, I teach just as much nationwide. I try to hit as many states as I can within a calendar year. So, 2018, I'm also starting to do dot specific classes. So it's basically my defensive handgun, but it's 4 red dot guns. And if you don't have a red dot gun, you can still come to the class and I'll have one for you. First come, first serve on that, because I don't have 12 of them.
Right.
But I'll be hitting the Midwest a little bit more in 2018 and trying to get back out to California, but I'm also getting up in the Northeast and Maryland. And my regular classes, I always hit Tennessee at least once, Florida a few times a year, Texas,
nice.
Ohio. So I stay on the road usually about 3 weekends a month teaching wherever.
Nice, dude. Well, hey, I appreciate you coming on today, man. Thank you very much. I hope you enjoy the rest of your day. Be safe, brother.
Yeah, thanks a lot.
Yeah. Make sure you guys check out our website, ballisticradio.com. Like our Facebook page at facebook.com/ballisticradio. And, hey, keep leaving those 5-star review on iTunes. We really appreciate it. Thanks for listening, everyone. As always, be safe. See you next week.